This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
At Target, everyone can find the beauty products that work for them at affordable prices. Target carries an extensive range of BIPOC-owned and founded beauty and skincare products, such as Thread Beauty, Shea Moisture, Naturium, and Hero. All of these products are available at everyday low prices, meaning you never have to compromise who you are and what's important to you when you shop. Inclusive BIPOC-owned beauty products for everyone, available at Target. Head to your local Target or visit target.com.
This podcast is proudly in association with Pitch Sport Football, the app that allows you to interact with other West Ham fans, pick your starting 11 and participate in fan time videos. This app is absolutely free, so like I've done, like X has done and like thousands of other West Ham fans have done, get this downloaded if you haven't already. That's Pitch Sport Football.
You're listening to the West Ham Way podcast with Dave and X. Oi, oi!
Hello and welcome to the West Ham Way podcast with myself, Dave Walker, and serial YTK blogger, ex-WHU employee. Over the years, we've had the pleasure of sitting down with a number of ex-pros to talk about their time at West Ham, and tonight we're going to relive a classic interview with Hammers legend Alvin Martin. We hope you enjoy this interview as much as we did.
So you came to West Ham, a lad from Liverpool. How did that all come about?
Well, I came down through a guy called John McBride, who was running a team in Liverpool, you know, 50 under 16 team in Liverpool, and he had a contact, Wally St Pierre at the club, and he knew obviously people like Ron Greenwood, and we had a meeting with Ron Greenwood and John Lyle in the Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool about a year before I came down here. Because I was already on Associated Schoolboy forms with Everton. And Everton dithered. And when I say dithered, they offered me a contract, but it wasn't a full apprenticeship. It was a semi-professional apprenticeship. And I decided that wasn't good enough, and I was going to get the train down to QPR and West Ham to have a trial. So I jumped the train down to QPR. The first 2 weeks there, we're running. It was pre-season. It was a good club. And they couldn't make their mind up on me. They wanted me to stay on for another 2 weeks. And I said that I was going on holiday, but I was coming to West Ham the following day. So I had a two-week trial at West Ham. I went there. I knew I had a second bite at the cherry at QPR. But within a week, Ron Greenwood had offered me a full apprenticeship, and I had no hesitation in signing it. As soon as I went into West Ham, it was just that I knew it was right.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually. Why did you know it was right?
Different reasons. You feel there's a friendliness about the club. As soon as I got to Chadwell Heath, I was given a kit role. I asked if I wanted a bite to eat before we trained. I said, yeah, where do I sit? He said, over there. I said, well, that's the first team. He said, doesn't matter, we all muck in here together. So that was one thing. You were close to everyone. You could see people like Billy Bonds and Trevor Brooken and sit and eat with them. The coaching was unbelievable. Ron Greenwood and John Lyle at that time. John Lyle was the assistant manager. and Ron Greenwood was an unbelievable. It's very hard to explain in a short time that we've got how excellent he was. In everything that he did, was there was a purpose to it, and John obviously took that philosophy through his career. And I was just very fortunate to turn up at a time when the coaches were fantastic. And the first year that Ronnie Boyce was a coach was that year. He was my youth team manager after I'd signed apprentice. So I was really fortunate. Everything just was in place for me.
Mm. So when you first got to the club, was there any players that kind of looked out for you, took you under their wing at all? You know, you've come all the way down from Liverpool. You'd like to think the elder pros might have...
And also, to jump on the back of that, that must be hard for a young lad. You're not going to a local club.
Yeah.
You're coming down south. And that's... I mean, I'm assuming it was a big cultural change in those days. Maybe it wasn't. But that must have been quite daunting for you as well, from a personal perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it was. The football was easy. I found the football easy. But, like, it was when... you go home and you didn't have enough money. So whereas like I was on £8 a week the first year, if I didn't have enough money at the end of the month, I couldn't get any money from anywhere. Whereas if you were living at home, like the lads who were living in West Ham and East Ham with their families, they could borrow £1 or £2, get them by for another few days. I didn't. It was things like that I found very difficult, although it made me grow up. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was hard. I think it's harder when the football's not going well. If the football, I couldn't wait to get up in the morning.
Mm.
I couldn't wait. I used to get excited going to bed thinking I'm going to get up in the morning. And I'd go down to the main ground where I'd catch the minibus and we'd load all the kit on as apprentices and we'd travel to Chadwell Heath. Ronnie Boyce would drive the minibus. We'd get all the kit out, lay it all out for the first team, get ours out. Then we'd train. Then we'd come back in. And then we'd get all the kits, put them all into the skips, take them back to the main grounds, get them all ready, washed and rolled for the following day. And we'd train in the afternoon and then we'd come back and load the skips ready for the following morning. I just loved it. I just thought it was a fantastic life. And I was genuinely excited about going in every day.
And was there any players that sort of... did look after you at all, okay, but like sort of.
I think that come later on. I could look after myself physically.
Yeah.
I think there was a bit of banter that I was on the end of initially.
Yeah.
But it was a very friendly club. The lads who were in there, Paul Brush, Alan Kirbisley, Jeff Pike, Terry Hurlock, Terry Sharp, Lou Murphy, Pat Creasy, you know, it was a really. And we got to the FA Youth Cup final that year.
Yeah.
So it was a good side that I'd come into and a very good time to be a West Ham player.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, if I've got this right, you made your debut against Aston Villa in 1978. What are your memories from that game?
I think that might have been 77. But I remember coming on. I can't remember if it was 3-1. There was only one sub in them days. And somebody must have got a knock. John brought me on. He said, go up front. I don't think he trusted me enough to go up the back. So I went up front and I had a header that just missed the post. But that was the first time I'd ever played in front of a crowd like that. A big crowd, you know.
What's that like? I mean, to us mere mortals, what does that feel like?
It's away from home, it's different. It's like what I found is the biggest thing was playing the first game at the Bowling, which was not long after that. I played a game, I gave a sub again. We were playing Coventry at the Bowling, and Jeff Pike got an eye injury really 5 minutes into the game. A really bad eye injury, ball caught him. I think he had a problem with his retina. Anyway, I came on after 5 minutes. And even then, John said to me, where do you want to go up front? Because I could play up front or at the back. I want to go at the back. And we were fighting a relegation battle at the time. So it was a big decision for John. He said, OK, we'll put you... He pushed Tommy Taylor into midfield and put me at the back. And we won the game. I think it was 2-0. And I had a good game. But that why I remember that is I'd only ever played reserve games at the Bowling before. Empty. Handful of people in there. And then all of a sudden, it's packed. And you feel it was a very suffocating sort of people, were like especially in the chicken one.
Yeah,
you could touch them. It was like weird. It was like you could see faces.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was. I mean, to be fair, it didn't bother me. I just clicked into game mode, which I didn't know what to expect. Really, nobody can prepare you for your first team talk as a manager or your first moment 5 minutes on a football pitch in front of 40,000. Yeah. Nobody can prepare you for that. You go in there and you find out about yourself. And fortunately for me, it was just natural.
Yeah.
And then obviously you went from that to then playing at Wembley in 1980 in the cup final. You know, what do you remember about that day and that side? I mean, and also we were obviously in the second tier at that point, so it was a big achievement at the time. You know, talk us about that day and the side.
I suppose we were underdogs, and to a certain degree people would have felt the pressures off you, but the one particularly harrowing experience of that day was getting on the coach in a hotel that we'd stayed in, about a 20-minute drive away from Wembley, and then the coach making its way towards Wembley, and about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles from Wembley, all of a sudden it's tail to tail, and all you can see is claret and blue scarves, and then Arsenal supporters would, and then the daunting visual of all of these West Ham fans, and then the doubt entering your head thinking, if I mess up today,
yeah,
I'm going to let all these people down. Yeah. I think that was something that you became totally apparent to me.
Mm.
Up until that point, I hadn't thought about it.
Yeah.
A bit stupid of me, really. But it was quite a daunting prospect.
Mm.
Thankfully, it didn't happen. But, you know, it can make or break a play, can't it, a cup final? And that was obviously when a cup final was the biggest game in the calendar.
Mm.
It was bigger than the Champions League.
Yeah.
It was a massive game. It's something I'd only ever watched on TV.
Mm.
So to be a part of that, it was like, it was very hard to explain.
Yeah.
It was like an out-of-body experience. Is this really happening to me?
Mm. Did the game just whiz by then?
It went really quick. The same sort of thing. I was really nervous before that once the game started, it was like game mode I was on. The weird thing was I'd been to the FA Cup final as a Liverpool supporter to watch Liverpool play Arsenal
in
1971 when Charlie George scored that goal.
Yeah, lay on the floor. Yeah.
So, you know, 9 years later, I'm actually in the tunnel ready to go out against the team that beat my team and we beat them.
Yeah,
that's surreal, isn't it?
That's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I mean, what a day as well. You know, Brooking to score with a header, and there's so much little sub stories in that game. You know, the Paul Allen incident with Willie Young was his name?
Right.
Yeah, there's just so many little subplots to that. And you know, my dad always talks about that game, and it's one of those games as a West Ham fan you wish you could, you know, if you could go back in time and attend, you'd do it. And,
that's the best West Ham day of my life. That was.
Yeah,
and also I think the day after.
Yeah,
it's fantastic because you've already achieved it. You're on a coach and going towards the town hall down East Ham, and you think the atmosphere.
Mm.
And what was great about that was it was West Ham supporters who were the majority were men. There weren't as many women then going to football as there are now, but they brought their wives and their family.
Mm.
So it was
obviously
thousands and thousands, hundreds, over 100,000, I would have thought, 150,000, I don't know how many.
Mm.
But it was all multiplied because people wanted to enjoy the festivities with their family.
You know? Well, one of my favourite photos at my family home now is my great-gran was 99 at the time we won the FA Cup, and she's out there in all those hundreds of thousands you're talking about, dressed in claret and blue with my other family members, and it's right there on our mantelpiece. So you're right, that image is, you know, for me, of my family, and you describing it there, I can really relate to
that. I think you'll probably have to be 99 before your family wait for a picture of you on the mantelpiece.
They're going to have to give up on that, because I ain't making 99, I can tell you that now.
Did you, silly question, did you celebrate that night? Was there a particular place you went, or was it a quiet one, wife's girlfriend's or a boy's one?
Well, my wife now was my girlfriend then, Maggie. So, we went back to the hotel. There was a reception of some sort. I couldn't drink then. I've never been, you know, a big drinker. If I had like four or five bottles of, or five pints of beer, I was all over the place. So we had a couple of drinks, but I remember not drinking a lot.
Mm.
And then drinking the odd bottle of beer on top of the Lacey's coach. We had a Lacey coach with not a double decker, it was a single decker, but where the actual the ventilators were, they'd taken them out. We roll up on top of the roof. I'm sure it wouldn't be allowed these days. But people just kept handing bottles up to me. I thought, well, I keep drinking them. But it was just brilliant. Just brilliant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can't put a price on memories like that, can you? You really can't.
No, you can't.
You're so lucky to have enjoyed that. I mean, people were lucky enough to enjoy it as a fan, but to have been a player and contributed to making so many people genuinely happy, that's a real special moment for you and any of the boys from that day.
And it's still a part of his...
I think that team as well. That team was it was an excellent team, but it was a team full of good guys.
Yeah.
You know, we all got on well. There wasn't there wasn't any problem with any one of those players. It was a really tight-knit outfit.
But you know, I'm going to ask you a question that we didn't think of before, but I know it's one that always Mark Ward always gets quite angry about. But what side was better, that cup side or the 85-86 side?
I would say the best one that I played in was the 81 side, because the reason I say that, I knew you were going to ask me that, so I wrote it down.
You had a better right winger.
Phil Parks played. There ain't many players out of the 86 team that would get in. There were a few in that team.
Yeah.
The 81 team had Trevor Brookin in it at its more or less peak. Yeah. Billy Bonds, Frank Lampard, Phil Parks, who was at his peak.
Yeah.
Alan Devonshire, who hadn't had the injury, his knee injury, he was at his peak.
Yeah.
So they all would have got in the best ever side.
Yeah.
So I wrote down Parks. Ray Stewart was another player, was at his peak. That Billy Bonds... I can never, you know, I think that obviously Frank was a fabulous player, so he would get in there. Brookin, I think Jeff Pike was an underrated player. He's a really underrated. I know that Liverpool, big teams wanted to buy Jeff Pike.
Oh, really?
So, you know, he was somebody that certainly he was an underrated player. Alan Dev was a no-brainer, one of the best players I ever played with. Mark Ward would have got in it.
No, would he?
Not just because he's me, mate.
Yeah,
but Mark Ward would have gone in that team. So
there you go,
that.
Wardy.
Yeah. I was going to say, wouldn't have been happy with you up until that point.
Crossy was the centre forward, and I think Frank and Tony. So Frank McAvaney and Tony Cotty. Which one of them you would have played? Because they would have got in that team. But it's which one would you have played? I can never make my mind up, because, I mean, Crossy, you'd have to play.
Yeah.
And one of them, either one of them two with Crossy would have been perfect.
Yeah. I tell you, his goals-to-game ratio, Crossy, he's so overlooked by West Ham fans, I think. He had a phenomenal goal-scoring record for West Ham.
But he was the leader as well. He would hear people, and he always wanted the ball. You know, if you were in trouble, you could either put it up on near his chest or up in the air, and he'd win it. Or if he didn't win it, he wouldn't let somebody else win it. he was a great player.
What I always find so interesting about David Cross is obviously he tells stories like that, and his nickname was Psycho and stuff. And then we had him as one of our guests at a pre-match event. He's the most, like, an absolute gentleman. Calm, well-spoken. And then you hear about his football personality, it sounds completely different. And you just find him as a real fascinating character. And my dad always said...
Billy Bonds is the same.
Yeah, true.
If I hadn't seen Billy Bonds play, I would not believe the sort of player he was.
Yeah.
Billy, because he's such a quietly spoken guy. You know, humility... It's a love, you know, they are good, but that team was a good team in every sense.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about daunting prospects, you then made your England debut against Brazil, I think it was in 1981. How was being with England different to West Ham, and why?
I think you're going out your comfort zone, number one. You've won, hopefully you've won over the West Ham fans, because I think I won Hammer of the Year that year. So, you know, you know they're on side. You feel confident in your surroundings, and all of a sudden you're going into an England setup where you've got to prove yourself all over again. So, you know, that could be disconcerting.
And did you feel like you belonged there when you arrived at the England camp?
Ron Greenwood was the manager, so it was nice that he was there. Trevor was in the squad. Billy Bonds was supposed to be in that squad. And
is that right?
Yeah, he was going to be. We were both going to play in that game. And we played a game the previous Tuesday or Wednesday, away at Sheffield Wednesday, and Bill made the fatal mistake of, after Phil Park shouts keepers, not getting out of the way. Which is, you know, there's only ever going to be one winner there. I don't care how hard you are.
Even to this day, he's a big landfill, isn't he?
Well, he broke two of Bill's ribs, and that was the reason that Bill didn't join up with the squad.
That's
a big regret, because we both would have played in that game against Brazil.
How did he take that personally, Bill?
He knew. Look, when I went into the medical room the day that we were joining up, I was desperate for him to go with me, because I was going into uncharted territory myself, and it would have been great to have him there. And he went, "I'm struggling here, Stretch." He called me Stretch. "I'm struggling here. I'm going to go for a run." Went out for a run and then come back into the medical room. Went, "No." And you knew he is.
He's not going to put it on.
He's one of the hardest men. Yeah. I mean, probably the hardest man I ever met. Would play with anything. And it didn't surprise me. As soon as he had an X-ray, it was broken, or two of the ribs were broken. Yeah. But he got out of the way next time, Parks. So
I bet. I mean, the thing is, Bill being Bill, I'm sure he probably wasn't even saying that because of, you know, pain thresholds. It was probably because he didn't want to let his country down, playing not as fit as he should.
You know what he said to me? He said the biggest regret he had about that was he felt sorry for his dad. He was more upset that his dad didn't get to see him play.
Really?
For England at Wembley. Because his dad, Mr. Bonds, used to watch reserve games and youth team games and come up to me one day and he said to me, "You're going to play for England." And I went, "Thanks, Mr. Bonds." He actually said that.
Really?
So it was something. He obviously knew the game. I'm sure he would love to have seen his son play. So from Bill's point of view, he was more upset that his dad hadn't.
Yeah, I can totally understand that.
Yeah. How did you get the nickname Stretch, by the way? That isn't one
Keith Robson gave it to me when I was in Diggs in East Ham. I used to be always lying on the floor eating chocolate and watching telly, and he's always stepping over me. When, you know, I did have long legs. So he gave it to me, and once he called me in training, that was it. Bill still calls me now. I spoke to Bonzo last week. He goes, "All right, Stretch."
And talking of Keith Robson, he did like a drink, didn't he, Keith?
Yeah, he liked anything with a B, like boozing, beer.
My kind of man.
He was a character. Yeah. In the days when perhaps you could get away with it, you couldn't get away with it now.
obviously, you then suffered an injury yourself and actually missed the 1982 World Cup. You know, how hard was that to deal with? And then, in return, you then made the 1986 World Cup, so the kind of contrasted emotions.
Yeah, well, the 82 one, I broke my collarbone in an England representative game up in Manchester and then came back and played a game in Coventry, I think it was, and Parksy again decided to...
it's a liability, Parksy.
He put a few of us out. He actually clattered me, rocked the shoulder, and it crunched, and I thought, I broke it again. Went home, and it wasn't broken. What it had done, it just shook the joint up, and I nearly made it. I played a game against Finland in Helsinki prior to the World Cup, but I knew it wasn't right because I hadn't had any games. So in the end, I didn't make that squad, and it hits you really when you start to watch it. I'd gone on holiday to Menorca with my girlfriend then, Maggie. And it was, as soon as I started watching it on telly, that's when, you gutted. It hits home and you're having to watch it rather than be there. So, yeah, but I got there in 86, so...
And how was that? How experience?
Well, 86 was mixed emotions because we'd had all of these games at West Ham that season where we'd finished third and we'd had two cup runs, league and FA Cup, where we had replays for Spomans, which meant that we'd had to have a lot of games in the last month or the last 6 weeks, a ridiculous amount of games. I can't remember how many it was. But we were out on our feet, really. And we were obviously still with a chance, I think, even with three games to go, of winning the title. But Liverpool went on one of them amazing runs, didn't they? And we didn't make it in the end. But I was physically tired, really tired, exhausted, I'd say. And I just needed 4 or 5 days. And I went to John Lyle, the manager, and said, is there any chance that, the gaffer Bobby Robson can give me 4 days just to chill out, and then I can join up later on. But they were flying out to Colorado to do altitude training. Anyway, he said go up to speak to Bobby and then discuss it with him. But I'm sure that'll be okay. I went, oh great. So I went up with my mate took me up there, Terry Clifford. I sat down, had a chat with him. He went, well, we're going to Colorado. It's a beautiful hotel. We're not going to be doing it. You sit around the pool. And he said, so you're coming. So I went, oh, I haven't got any gear with me. He said, don't worry. He sent the car, get all my gear, and he brought it back, and I ended up flying off with them. And when we did get there, he told me a little white lie because we were doing altitude training, which was pretty hard. So there wasn't any rest. So I think he just once said, look, I want to get my squad all out there at the same time. I think the Liverpool players and the Everton players were flying out later because they were playing in the cup final that year. That's what happened.
And then you played, I don't know how many games you played, and then you would drop for the Argentina game.
I only played the one because they played the previous two. Portugal, was it Morocco? I can't remember who it was now. But anyway, the third game was against Paraguay. And we obviously needed to win that game to get out the group stages. So I played in that game. We won the game 3-0. It all went well. And I just assumed I was going to play in the following game against Argentina until I think it was the 2 or 3 days before. We sat down. the team talk. You give the team out straight away, one change, Fenwick in for Martin, and that was it. I can't remember what else was said. I can't remember anything.
Yeah.
I just remember walking around the hotel, and I'd already flown my dad out there. So my dad was out in Mexico City, staying in the same hotel as us. So I had to go and tell my dad, which wasn't a nice.
And he didn't explain the decision at all.
That was it. That was the team. And
Well, with hindsight, probably wasn't a bad thing after what Maradona did to that defence.
I don't think anyone could have stopped Maradona's second goal.
Yeah, yeah.
And who knows what would have happened, because England came on strong, really.
Mm-hmm.
The last 5 or 10 minutes, we could have got level, but look, it's happened. My overriding memory was just watching it in the Aztec Stadium and seeing somebody who was so much better than everyone else.
Well, who knows, if Parks would have been in goal that day,
yeah, exactly.
And he would have come charging out of the AJ, it could have been a different outcome.
He wouldn't have been coming down a day later, wouldn't he?
Yeah, exactly. No hand of God then.
Please help me, God.
Exactly.
I mean, you mentioned the Hammer of the Year award. I mean, that is obviously one hell of an accolade for any West Ham player, and I think you won it in that era in 1980 and 1982,
I won it three times. I can't remember what years it was, but it was early 80s. Yeah,
yeah, so
1980 was the first one, I'm sure.
Yeah, so around that sort of time that we're talking about at this stage. And I mean, that's got to be, it is an achievement, but how seriously did you take that? I mean, was that did you see that as a real achievement, or was it just I don't want to say throwaway, but how seriously did you take winning that award?
Look, it was the most important individual award in my eyes.
Yeah.
That you could win. If you said to me you could win the Football Writers Award or the Hammer of the Year Award, Hammer of the Year Award every time. People who watch it every week. People who watch it week in and week out, home and away, a lot of them.
Yeah.
So absolutely. When you get that, the funny thing was, I felt that maybe in two of the three of my best years, I didn't win it. You know, 86, I had a good season in 86. Machiavelli, did he win it? Machiavelli? Yeah. Or 40, I don't know. Banging all them goals in. So you know, I think when in the early 80s, we had some good players in that team.
Yeah.
You know, so I look back and think, oh, blimey, how did I do that? You know, with Brooking and Bonds and Devonshire and
one hell of an achievement.
Stewart.
Yeah, incredible.
So from that point of view, I'm incredibly proud. It probably as an individual award, certainly the most proudest.
Yeah, because I've always wondered, and obviously I've assumed that it does mean something to players to win that award, but I've always wondered just how much it means to the player to win that award. So I was just interested to hear your answer on that.
Do you still have the trophies at home?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, okay.
Three of them. Yeah,
brilliant. We've talked about it a bit, obviously, how the 85-86 team. You played 40 out of the 42 games, I think, in the league that year. You've talked about why the 1980 team was so special. But what was it that was so special about that team, the 86 team?
It had good footballers, but it had devilment. It had been naughtiness in it. So people, you know, maybe like Mark Ward. McAvaney, who, you know, didn't respect anyone really. They just went, now we're here and we don't care who you are.
Yeah.
And we're gonna go out. And I think we needed that. We needed that ingredient within
fire.
And they brought something really different. And what that did, it sparked other people up around the pitch. Alan Dickens was fantastic that year. Tony Cotty seen Frank McAvaney come in and looked at Frank McAvaney and went, you know what? I could do a little bit more of what he does. And I think McAvaney can look to Tony and think, I want to be able to finish as cleanly as that. And they complement each other. And I think they did improve as a duo because of each other. So everything just went right. You know, we started off and gradually there was a spirit building within the side. I remember two games in or three games in, we'd have a meeting on our own, you know, which John vetoed. It was no problem. But we'd sort things out on our own. And if somebody wasn't doing a shift, they'd be told in the right way. So there was an integrity and honesty within that group that was very important, I think.
One thing Waldy's always said is that if that side would have had Julian Dix, you wouldn't have won the league, you'd have pissed it. Do you agree with that?
I think that Julian would have been it would have been certainly one of the ingredients that you think were perfect. Whether or not he'd played that many games, because he'd been him and Wardy in the same team, back of any as well, you know, would have ended up getting a few red cards, I think. But I think the position up front, I think, was important. I think we had a possibility of maybe getting somebody like Mick Harford in at that time. And I think Tony and Frank maybe could have been utilised a little bit different. But look, this is all, it's all ifs and buts, isn't it? I think there were different reasons. We maybe didn't go out and strengthen in maybe a couple of positions that then we could have. We thought we could replicate the season before, and why not? Mm. But we did get injuries the following year. I remember, I think 5 games into the season, I got sent off. And in training, I had a really bad knee injury. Come down and my knee was blown up and I didn't play for 6 weeks. But while I wasn't playing, I'd had a problem with my foot. A tiny little problem. Didn't stop me playing anyway. But I knew I had a little problem there. I had an arthritis in the first metatarsal of my right foot. And for some reason, that flared up when I'd been incapacitated by the knee injury. And that was the beginning of the worst time. 3 years on and off with ejections, operations on my feet, and they weren't sorted out. And I went back and he said, look, there's nothing wrong with your foot, the specialist. I went, well, it must be in my head then. And I had 3 or 4 years of not being fit. So that was something. The only thing I changed about my whole career, I would have said, I'm not playing. Till that foot's sorted out, I'm not playing. Eventually did get it sorted out. There was a problem with the foot, which hadn't been diagnosed right. So, but it was 3 years too late. Mm. So I lost, really, I reckon I lost from 29 to 32, 33, could have been my best years.
And a lot of people say that's the peak of a footballer's career.
Well, yeah. And I look back now, that was a problem for me. Because it caused, having that problem with my foot caused problems with my back, with my hamstring. I don't have to tell you, if you've got problems with your back and your hamstring, and you, I felt like I needed a good oil. It was a tough time, that.
I'm going to ask you a question now. I'm sure you've answered 1,000 times, if not more. But we cannot talk about the 86 season without talking about the win over Newcastle, where you famously scored a hat-trick against 3 different keepers. And is it right, from memory, from when I've spoken to you before, you didn't know you'd scored a hat-trick against 3 different keepers until someone told you after? Is that right?
That's right. Trevor Smith of the Recorder. You know that every goal was against different goalkeeper. I went, Trevor, was it really? He said, yeah. I used to just be so focused on the game, I wouldn't have been able to tell you what was going on half the time. But no, that's right. It was the 3 goals against 3 different goalkeepers. The first one was the first proper keeper. He must have only been half fit. And it was in the days where there was only one sub. So Martin Thomas got injured. I'd scored a goal against him, relatively close range volley, I think. And then the second keeper was Chris Hedworth, who I'd scored a header against. And late on in the game, I think we were 7-1 up, no pressure on us whatsoever. The game was won. We got a penalty, and the goalkeeper for them was Peter Beasley. So if you're ever going to be confident, take a penalty.
I was going to say, did everyone want to take it?
A tiny little goalkeeper, you're 7-1 up. Yeah. I did eventually persuade Ray Stewart that it was best he let me take the ball.
So what was the persuasion? That it was your hat trick and
the crowd was singing. They were aware. I don't know if they were aware it was against a different goalkeeper every time, but they were certainly aware that it was me hat trick. So they more or less demanded that I took the penalty.
I'm sure, talking to Peter Beardsley, you told me a story previously about when you roomed with him. Does that ring any bells?
Yeah.
Go on, you've got to tell it, because I found that really funny.
Well, he went the prettiest, was he, with all his teeth in, but like he used to have a pallet with 3 or 4 teeth in it, which he used to take out every night and put it by the side of his bed in a glass of water. And I woke up one night, reached for the glass of what I thought was my water and took it out of it, and then his pallet.
Oh, my God.
I think he lost one tooth out of that pallet as I threw it against the wall. So even now, I can feel myself feeling a bit queasy when I think about that.
Yeah. Oh, God, how funny. I know that Waldy told me a story about Peter Beardsley.
I was going to say that I've heard another story, and I think it was Waldy.
This made me laugh as well. Obviously, I've never met him, but he sounds like a character, Peter. And I think Everton were getting a bit of a tanking, I think. And at half time, Howard Kendall's come in and he said, right, boys, I'll tell you now, there's going to be a few new faces in this dressing room. And Peter Beardsley pipes up and said, can I have one, boss? really funny.
He weren't the prettiest.
Good player, though. Yeah, very good player.
Brilliant player. Like, even in his later years at Newcastle, was very good, wasn't he? We've kind of talked about it a bit in the past, in the previous questions. So, obviously, we finished third in the league in 86, best ever season. And then within a few years, we were relegated. What went so wrong after that?
I think maybe we didn't strengthen. Then we had injuries the following year. Then I think Frank and Tony were on their way very soon after that. So, you know, I think Tony went to Everton, Frank went to Celtic. So we lost the heartbeat of the team. And I don't think me and Tony Gale played another 15 games together, you know, in succession after that. So the team that had done so well wasn't the same team in terms of personnel.
So they were...
I mean, I think also is when you do well like that, there's more pressure on the following year. It doesn't get easier; it gets harder. So you think, okay, well, we finished third, we could have done a little better, maybe. This could be our year. Whereas we should have been thinking in our mindset, we should be saying this is going to be harder than last year. People are wised up to us now; they know what our strengths are, how we play. They know everything about our team. Maybe that's a part of what happened as well.
Yeah.
I mean, all ex-pros, players, staff and fans just cannot speak highly enough of John Lyle. Obviously, he's a legend at the football club. And obviously, I know you enjoy playing for him, Alf. How did you feel when he was sacked?
I think it was like unthinkable, really, that John wasn't going to be manager there for 20, 30, 40 years. And I can personally feel that... a sense of responsibility, you know. I was part of the team that got him the sack, and that's the way I felt in myself. And with John, I spoke to him. I was away. I was abroad when the news hit, and I phoned John. And obviously, everyone was trying to phone him, but it just seemed a really poor way for it to end as well. The great thing about John was, look, you won't find a player that won't say anything but good things about John. That's how good John was. He was fantastic. And even if you weren't in his team, you respected him. So just a fantastic gentleman. And I owe him a lot, John. He had so many friends within the game, management, other directors, everyone sort of coveted what he built at West Ham and what he stood for. But he's somebody that I just feel really sorry that I didn't get a chance to properly say goodbye. And when he came back with another team, Ipswich, even then, standing in the tunnel, John come out to the door and I looked at him and I just nodded. I didn't say, "Hi, John," and, you know, put my arms around him, because I was just focused on the game. It was weird, you know. I do regret that. But
that's been strange for him as well, coming back.
Years later, we were at a function up in London, a West Ham function, and we all got invited into the room, loud applause. When John walked in the room, it reached a new level. And John was genuinely taken aback by the emotion and love that he was feeling in the room. And I remember thinking, that's a really nice memory there, for me.
It's nice that he experienced that. Everyone would want that for him. Do you know how he handled the sacking?
Well, badly. He was a pretty forthright character, John. You know, everyone's got this sort of a perception of him being quiet, measured. And he was measured, but he could blow off steam. And I think he was angry more than anything. I think he'd given so much to the club. And, you know, trying to get money out of John for a contract, it was like his own money, you know. But he was doing a job on every level. He was negotiating contracts. Yeah. He was getting in players. He was sorting out the scouting. He was sorting out the training.
Proper manager.
He did everything. Just a great man.
And obviously he was, Lou Macari came in, and then we had Billy Bonds, your playing days, mate. How did you take to his appointment?
Bill was, well, we were all delighted.
Yeah. You know?
Bill was the obvious man, and he had everyone's respect within the dressing room. And Bill did the job just exactly as he played, dead straight. He was honest with everyone. If he didn't think you were doing well, he'd tell you. If he did think you were doing well, he'd tell you. It was nothing. Look, I think sometimes you've got to be a little bit deceitful to be a good manager, and that's something that Bill would never have. He'd look you straight, and he didn't have that in him. And for some reason, he got away with it. Whereas, you know, another manager could not have got away with it, but Bill was straight, and you think, well, that's Bill, and he's telling me the truth, and I know where I stand with him.
Yeah,
We got promoted under Bill. Shortly after that, what do you remember about that time?
I remember him being, I don't know, with Bill in charge, he always instilled confidence in you as a player. You think, oh, I want Bill alongside me. If Bill's in my team, we got a chance. And I felt like he was a bit like that as a manager as well. You know, he never ever felt that we were going to go in and lose a game. Do you know what I mean? He always set up, doesn't matter who we were playing, set up to be positive. And obviously we did lose games, but like you think, okay, we'll dust yourself down, stand up, get on with it again. And that's the way he tried to run his team. And so some of the stuff that when he was playing, he tried to instill into the team that he was managing. Obviously, it doesn't always work 100%, but I think he did a good job. And he was, again, you talk about the times that Billy was managing West Ham, they were pretty tough times. You know, there was a tough job to be doing. The bond scheme was on. There was a lot of,
distractions.
So there was, there's lots of stuff going on. So yeah, he did a remarkable job, really.
Yeah, and then in other similar circumstances to John Lowe, he left under a very, a dark cloud, and was replaced by his supposed close mate Harry Redknapp. And we've all heard the stories and the talk about what actually happened then, but as a player at that era and being in and amongst it all, what did you make to what happened, and how much did you know about it, and was it then hard to accept Harry as the manager after that?
Well, there'd been a twosome, and Bill was hard, straight. Harry was very affable. He'd arms around you, jokey, and so they were a good cop, bad cop, but not a good pairing and well balanced pairing. Obviously, being friends, best man at weddings, all of that. When the news come that Bill had moved upstairs, had been offered to move upstairs, and gone, we were told, and Harry come in and told us what had happened. We just all were a bit stunned, but also think, okay, well, that's the way it is. We've got to get on with it. My personal take on that was because I didn't know that Bill and Harry had a fallout at that time. I thought it was a decision that had been made above, and that was it. I think when you're faced with that proposition as a player, what you do is you pull the West Ham shirt on, you play.
Just block it.
You're getting paid to play football for West Ham United. So, yeah. You go out, what are you going to do? Not train properly? Not have a moan up or whatever it is? So, there was only one alternative, and that was to go out and play.
Well, you played until 1996, so a phenomenal amount of time at West Ham. How does that feel after close to or over 20 years playing for West Ham, that suddenly comes to an end?
Well, the last day, Sheffield Wednesday, I think it was, it was weird because although I knew it was going to come to an end, there was one moment in the day when I went out onto the pitch and Harry Redknapp made a presentation of some glass to mark, the retirement. And it wasn't until he handed me it and I looked at it and it dawned on me that I wasn't ever going to be walking onto that pitch again in that capacity. And that was I don't know if I like this. So that was a moment. But look, my life's been full. I've got three kids. I've got, I was running a business at the time. So I had a lot of things going on in my life.
Life outside of football was already set up.
I was always okay with all that. Some people struggle to come to terms with it. For me, it was pretty easy.
So obviously, Dave said about how long you're at the club, a very loyal servant of West Ham, extremely loyal. Was there any times during that period that you had offers from other clubs? And who were they? And did it ever get close to you leaving?
It never got close to me leaving. I think I knew that I found out later, and I also got tapped up a couple of times. So I knew that Arsenal and Tottenham had been in for me three times.
Really? Gosh.
Everton, Leeds. So I know that, but in those days, I think John Lyle had a really high standing within the game. Nobody poached his players, because if John ever found out, he'd never give somebody, you wouldn't do that. Other managers wouldn't do that. They'd do it to other managers, but not to John Lyle. So I think there was a trust that people wouldn't be poached. Although, like I said, it did happen once or twice where there was discreet inquiries made. But I was just happy there. I never ever crossed my mind to leave the club. In fact, I think towards the end when I was struggling with injuries, there was a chance that Bill wasn't going to offer me a contract, which I mentioned early on. And then I got back in the team, played a few games, and then we're having a discussion about money, and Bill went, I don't know if we can pay that. I said, well, all right, Bill. I said, but I've got another club that's contacting me. And he said, who is it? I said, it doesn't matter who it is, but he said, no, who is it? I said, it's Tottenham. And he went, oh, no. we agreed the contract within 2 hours.
Brilliant. And were they actually in for you at that
time?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, they were. Yeah. Brilliant.
Oh, how funny. I've got to ask you, and I'm sure I know the answer to this, or maybe I don't. If there wasn't a future for you at West Ham, would you have gone to Tottenham?
If there wasn't
a future for you at West Ham, and Tottenham was the main kind of front runner,
look, if Tottenham would have come in and said, "Look, you know, West Ham don't want you anymore," of course I would have. Yeah. You know, and it probably would have. I'm sure it wouldn't have gone down well with a lot of the fans. But what would they have done? You know, faced with that, I had a mortgage still.
Yeah, of course.
Three young kids.
And money then wasn't what money's now in the game.
That's right. No. From that point of view, I think, I would have had to take that offer.
Yeah. I know that you briefly had some time playing alongside a young Rio Ferdinand. I think you might have trained with him as well for a short period of time up until that last game where you played alongside him. Did you see something special in him at that time you had with him at West Ham?
I was always surprised that Man United had to wait for Leeds to go in and buy him, and then buy him from Leeds for like double the money that Leeds had paid. You know, I thought, why don't you go in and get him now? Obviously, he's going to be a player.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, he didn't have to be Einstein in terms of scouting to see that Rio was going to be a very good player. He had the right mentality. He could play with the ball, pace to burn. He was a no brainer. You know, I think sometimes you look at a player and I think, it's like Declan Rice now. It's what hasn't Declan got? Experience. But he's got everything else. He can play, he can tackle, he wants to defend. He will get better. Hopefully he'll get better in terms of his decision making. But you can tell he's an intelligent player. So I think this one of the biggest winners could be Declan Rice with Pellegrini, because Pellegrini will want to play and he will be given license to make the odd mistake, but also to start things off in the back.
If a young Declan Rice came to you and said, "Alvin, what advice can you give me?" What would you give him?
Be careful who you listen to. Be careful who you know. There's going to be a lot of people out there who criticise you who don't know what they're talking about. So never be above criticism, but take it with a pinch of salt.
Interesting, and but yeah, very powerful words as well. I get that 100%. I think you're right.
So obviously, when you left West Ham, you went to Orient, played a few games there, and then ended up managing Southend. Why do you feel that management didn't really work out for you as such, and you never really went back into it after the Southend experience?
Well, this could take an hour, this answer. But look, I took the job on. It was a really tough job to take on at a tough time. But it didn't go well. And then, you know, I think you have to really strip yourself down and really look at yourself in a way that probably I wasn't prepared to do for 6 months to a year afterwards. And then you start to think, well, could I have done that better? Yes, I could have done that better. What about my buys or the training or everything? I mean, the training was always very good. I felt that the sessions that I put on were, I think the players would say that. But the actual philosophy of what we were trying to achieve and how we were trying to achieve it maybe could have been drummed into them more. And at the end of the day, I look back now and think, no, I wasn't good enough. You know, and that's the bottom line. It's just like when a team gets relegated, it's ultimately because they're not good enough.
Yeah.
There might be other, different variations of why, and there might be an element of truth in all them, but first and foremost, somebody's not good enough. So, I never felt the need to go back into it, because I'd done it and it took a lot out of me. But I tell you what, it teaches you about yourself, because as a player, you're always in a group, or there are times when you're being asked or criticised individually, but you're always, you can share that with other people. But when you're a manager, it really did, it did take a lot, an exhausting experience, especially when it don't go well. It's exhausting when it goes well, when it don't go well, but it does teach you about yourself. And I don't regret doing that at all, because now I can sit here really comfortable where I am.
Yeah, and not regret the fact that you didn't do it.
Yeah.
But I can imagine that could be a lonely place, management.
Yeah. Oh, it is. That first half an hour after you get back into your little office and there's nobody there, you've been beaten, and things haven't been going well for a few weeks or whatever it is, and you can hear the crowd chanting, they want you out. That's not nice. I don't care who you are. Some people front it out, but like underneath they're hurting. You wouldn't be human.
Yeah, exactly. No, absolutely. When you look back, all those years playing for West Ham, what kind of comes to the forefront of your mind that's special memories? And it could be anything. It could be a game, it could be a goal, it could be winning trophies. What comes to the forefront of your mind that you class as memories that will stay with you forever?
I think just being, walking into the ground very early on, in the first month or whatever, and training at the main ground, being with a group of lads all trying to make their way as apprentices. So we've got 2 years to do it. And then training, getting your vouchers to go around Cassatari's, 40p, steak pudding, chips and beans. I used to love that. Yeah. That was fantastic. So there were moments like that early on in the apprenticeship, and then getting to the Youth Cup final. But the togetherness and the closeness and the characters in that dressing room, that was a lovely time to be joining. And I think, and I've said it to you early on, that's like, just being excited about getting up in the morning. I remember getting up in Canning Town and seeing the fog and thinking, oh no, we're not going to be able to train. I was gutted that we weren't going to be able to train. So yeah. I loved it that much, and I think that to be able to go into work and feel you are lucky, aren't you?
You just don't get enough players in today's game with that sort of mentality. No. I think that's the problem.
I do think that is the difference between the modern-day footballer and the footballers gone by. Some now are more interested in what their social media accounts say or how much money is in their bank account rather than the actual fundamentals of wanting to go and play football. And I think that's the difference nowadays between a footballer that makes it and a footballer that doesn't. It's that desire, isn't it, to be a footballer? I mean, I think Matty Everington was saying to me the other day, he's just got the Peterborough under-18s manager's job, and he said, you have to make being a footballer that one thing that you want and you focus on, and that you give everything to that. And I think too many probably don't. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but
I think you're right. I think the money comes a little bit too early, and they don't focus on where they can improve. I'd like to think that if we were playing now, that the money that we'd be earning would take the pressure of mortgage and bringing kids up out of it, and then you could just play purely for the football.
Do you think that's the case, or do you think, obviously this wouldn't be the case with yourself, anyone will tell you that, but even players around you back then, do you think that would be the case for them, or do you think that you would see complacency from players that you didn't back then because they were they wasn't blessed with unlimited pound notes in the bank, shall we say?
I just think everyone's different. I think there's people like who Bill would come in and train harder than anyone else, stay out afterwards, do his extra bits. Frank Lampard would be doing doggies, I'd be doing headers. Once John blew the whistle, so he finished, we wouldn't go in. We'd stay out and do some extra stuff because that's the way we'd been brought up. I think it's the way you're brought up.
Generational thing as well, I think, yeah.
So, but not everyone was the same. Dixie wouldn't. Frank McAvenny wouldn't. Frank McAvenny, get him on the football pitch, and Julian on the football pitch, and they'd run through a brick wall for you.
Yeah.
So you've got to understand, you can't sort of just say, okay, that's the way it is. Everyone is different. And look, there were probably players in our dressing rooms in the past who maybe aren't as desirable as characters as some others, but they were vastly outnumbered. So the goodness of a dressing room would be strong because one bad apple in there wouldn't be enough. You'd have to get four or five and things not be going well for it to all come down, which I have experienced as well. But then that 1980-81 team, there wasn't one person in there that didn't adore John, adore the job, and what we were all doing. That season when we used to go outside the top flight and just get on the coach. I've got a visual picture of it now. Getting on the coach, normally you'd won the game by more than one, two goals, and we'd have our card school. Rob Jenkins, the physio, would be coming around serving us our salmon and prawns. Parks, he'd be sitting at the front of the bus with a cigar and a brandy. it was you wanted it to be a 4-hour Janie, because we were having such a good time.
Yeah.
We had Rob Jenkins as one of our guests on the show a little while ago.
Great man.
He's some a great of the character.
Stories he told us well, he's about... got more stories than anyone, Rob Jenkins. And a genuinely funny man as well.
He's brilliant.
Hilarious.
He was the stories he told us. I mean, gosh, we could be here all night if we retold those, but they're great. we've kind of touched upon it in the previous questions, but let's put it right down now on paper. Your all-time 11 that you played with, let's make it a final 11 now.
I can never look. I've been asked to do this before. I can never do it. I can give you a nearly team.
Yeah,
Phil Parks in goal, Ray Stewart right back. I can never make my mind up. And all the players I play with, Frank or Julian. Julian, like, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Frank because he was Frank. It's solid, hard, reliable. Julian, not as reliable, but like, what a left foot, you know, and scored some fantastic goals. So I can never make my mind up about the left back.
Yeah.
You know, Bonzo's, you know, I loved playing with Bonzo. So as a centre half, he's fantastic. Mm. Mark Wood would get in as a right winger because he had a bit of everything, Woody. Mm. Go past people, score goals, create, total team player.
Mm.
Dev, when he was like at his peak, was unbelievable. Mm. So, you know, he's as good a player as I ever played with. Trevor. For obvious reasons, you know, the just class. Dicko or Jeff Pike, you know, Pike is probably a better foil for Trevor. So you say Pike, you know, was an underrated player.
Mm.
And then I'd put David Cross in, and I mentioned him already. You know, Paul Goddard was a great centre forward. You know, he was at the time, them 2 years, 80, 81, 82, he was a handful to play against, scored a lot of goals. But you'd have to say McAvaney and Cotty over a period of time, their records were probably better than Sarge's.
Mm.
So it's which one would you put with them with David Cross? You know, Frank McAvaney, who would run and run and run and run beyond him, or Tony Cotty that would play off him and score a lot of goals as well.
Mm.
So it's a centre forward I can't make mind up, and the left back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've given you nine.
Well, do you know one player as well that I thought might also challenge is Ludo, possibly. With, I know Phil was as good now,
Ludo,
as he was.
I understand why you say that.
Yeah, because Ludo...
But Phil was unbeatable on any given day, unbeatable. I played in front and with some great Shilton, Clemens, Chris Woods, Joe Corrigan. You know, they were... But on any given day, there was times we'd do shooting practice at the end of a session and you'd have to score a goal to go in. So you give it, get it back, you're in it from 18 yards, just outside, but we could not get in.
Mm.
You know, we'd be out there, I mean, in the end, John would have to say, all right, all in, because Parks, he wouldn't let us score. He just was unbeatable.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. Best player you've ever played with?
Billy Bonds.
Bill,
yeah. Billy, you know, look, for talent, it might be... pure talent, someone else. Although Bill had talent, don't get me wrong.
Mm.
But could play right back, centre mid, centre half.
Yeah, versatile as well. A lot of people forget that.
But he was just a phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, he's the one that, like I said, you know, out of everyone I've played with at West Ham, if you said to me, you know, pick a team, you've got to win this game. It's the most important game you'll ever play. You can, who's your first name? Bonzo will be it.
Yeah.
Mm.
A slight adaption to X's question: five-a-side team.
They're really pushing.
Well, Devonshire, definitely. Brooklyn. I probably would play Dixon.
Would you?
Yeah. Bonds. And then Parksy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how good was Alan Devonshire? Because I was actually half expecting you to say Dev, being the best player that you played with, and obviously Bonzo, there's no arguing with that. Yeah. But Dev was something else, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was somebody that we brought in $5,000 from Southall, and
that's amazing.
The first game I played was Oxford City in some sort of reserve. I think they were in reserve league. Anyway, first 5 minutes into the game, he's picked the ball up on the edge of our box and he started to run with it, and somebody's running after him, who I thought was quite quick and couldn't get near him. And he went away from him, and then somebody else ran after him, and he went past him. He must have been four or five people, and he ended up on the edge of their box with the ball and had a tame shot. But I remember thinking to myself, he ain't bad. And he that's what he did. He just ran with the ball, and then he learned to be able to check inside and play and then follow the ball, get it back. But when we used to do one and two touch in the gym, we did a lot of tight stuff with John and Ron Greenwood. But John then, when Dev was there, all in little 10-yard squares, and we played one and two touch. and Dev was unbelievable. We were all pretty good at it because we did it regularly. Mm. But Dev and Trevor had eyes in the back of their head. They could see things that we couldn't see. Mm. And the ball would be gone before you got anywhere near them.
That's fascinating.
That's really intrigued. You've played with so many good players. Okay, it's the 89th minute. It's the cup final. It's a penalty. Julian Dix or Ray Stewart takes it for you?
Or Alvin Martin.
Yeah, yeah.
Depends if he's on the crowd or something.
I'd definitely be third on my list. Yeah. Ray Stewart.
Okay. Hey,
really? Yeah. You give it to Ray, would you? Yeah,
just for purely mental strength. Playing, scoring a goal. When he went up to the League Cup final, I had a header that was flicked over the bar by Terry McDermott, which I'll never forgive him for, because that should have been a goal. Mm. But anyway, we got the penalty right in the last minute. Mm. And he went up and he passed it into the net. We'd been smashing them in all season. Yeah. And he just passed. So we had a variety of finishes, and it was so cool, Ray. He was the one that mentally... I think it was an edge because, well, mentally Julian was mental, but Ray, I think, under real extreme pressure, scoring. If he scores that, if he misses that, we're out the cup final.
For composure, you give it to Tonka. As always, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and we hope to have you again soon. And thanks for giving us your time, Alf.
Thank you very much for having me, X and Dave.
Custom Ink is an awesome way to recognize employees, thank customers, and outfit your teams with their favorite products and brands customized with your logo. CustomInk.com lets you make your mark on water bottles, backpacks, polos, jackets, and a ton more. Custom Ink is your go-to custom gear partner with great customer service, quality products, and all-in pricing, along with personalized help when you need it and an easy-to-use website when you don't. Oh yeah, and everything is 100% satisfaction guaranteed. Check out what we can do for your business at CustomInk.com.
Moms are amazing at tracking down hard-to-find items. Library books, socks, you name it. But sometimes help is welcomed. Care.com makes it easy to find babysitters near you. Sitters with the experience and skills your family needs, like after-school pickup and homework help. You just post a job for qualified sitters to apply. And since all Care.com caregivers are background checked, you can feel confident about interviewing and hiring. To get the child care help you need, sign up now at Care.com.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.